What's up? Welcome to Sweathead with Mark Pollard. I have Tom Trenter, who runs an intentionally small and focused strategy agency called Positive in Chicago. What's up, Tom? Welcome.
Doing great. How are you, Mark?
I'm doing very, very well. We're going to have a chat today about running a strategy agency and then doing research and strategy with big, probably Midwestern clients, but also national clients as well. So first one, let's bite off a question. Why did you decide to set up a strategy agency in the first place? Why does the world need one of these?
Yeah, thanks for asking. I came out of big agency background where I was a planner inside agencies working with my account teams and creative teams. Had a great peer group of planners that I worked with and really fell in love with planning and strategy early in my career and came to the understanding the more time I spent inside the agencies where you're really focused on communication, when you start building better client relationships and you get to see more of what's happening beyond the communication walls with product development, bigger brand positioning, innovation plans, package development, graphic, all the different things that come into marketing, I came to the realization it's much more fun to be on the side of the business where we are inventing and creating things than just communicating about the things that other people created and invented. Within that, the ability to take what was formerly a planner skill set and bring it to a broader strategic platform was really exciting. Found some friends in the business and we banded together and found some like-minded ways to get at the business and really expand our offering to become what we think are valuable strategists who can see across opportunities. And when you are partnered up as a good strategist and you're really driving strategy, there's endless opportunity to work with those clients to influence those brands.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever, I felt maybe 10, 12 years ago, there was this period in planning where a lot of us thought we were going to get closer to the business and potentially actually doing that through, I guess what people these days call digital business transformation. And I bought into that idealism. Then I moved to America and realized that advertising is advertising. And then as the algorithms came and changed, advertising became more advertising. Mm-hmm. And I really had to let go a lot of that idealism. Well, if you know, based on maintaining a similar career trajectory. Did you get affected by those ideas early on or at any point in your career?
I think the thing for me that was the biggest driver was being inside the big agency, you're part of a big team. And when you're working with clients, I've heard you in some of the recent podcasts even talking about how having to justify the planning role or finding the right way for the planner to have the biggest influence. And perhaps with a bit too much confidence and bravado, I was really interested in our work as its own product and the ability to work with clients where they're hiring us for the strategy development in absence of a specific next step. So our work goes to influence designers and product teams and communication teams. And I think within the agency, that wave of, hey, we're going to get closer to being able to touch a broader range of things within the client side, I completely bought into, probably like you did. And when I felt it wasn't coming to fruition, I was like, well, that's what I want to do. And I'm not finding the opportunity here. And a lot of that was the impetus to pick up, start fresh and find a way to do it. Cause I felt it was the right thing to do. I thought we'd be good at it. And it was just a pure push to get into the business and try to make something happen.
Yeah. And I think there are these little pockets of idealism now that I hear about a lot. One is doing strategy in essentially a pre-sales role for a publisher or a tech company, or you're like agency relations inside companies selling to agencies, and people go in thinking they're going to be doing brand strategy and they're not going to be doing brand strategy or creative strategy. And they're typically trying to help sell, which is totally fine. But I think that can also cause a little bit of an existential confusion, in the same way that I felt a bit confused for a couple of years thinking that we were moving towards what I used to call non-advertising ideas, but also potentially using our skill set to affect a business and the product. And it was like, why isn't this happening? But I think there are other things like that out there right now. I want to talk to you about buying and selling strategy. Based on now being frontline of people buying from you, what could you teach people about how people buy strategy? Why do they do it? What are they looking for? What are they not looking for? What do you have to explain to them so that they're able to buy in a correct or useful way?
Yeah, this is a great topic. And we spend a lot of time thinking about it as we're working with existing clients or new clients. And that question that you ask at the beginning of the buying and selling of strategy, I think there's two parts to it. So one of them is, what are they really looking for? And what's the question behind the ask? I know we ask that a lot, but there's times that clients will come to us asking a question and really trying to see what's behind it. And once we get a sense of, what is it they're really looking for in this situation? Are they in a place where they see a bright light in the future and they think to themselves, we think there's something over there. We don't quite know how to get there, but we're looking for optimism and hope and someone who's a driver to help us get to that thing that we see. Those are the best opportunities when they come in, because what they're really saying is, we want to be led. We are excited. We don't really know where we're going. We think you can help us get there. Let's go on that journey together. And when you have that opportunity and when you understand that that's really the task, it changes a bit the dynamic of quote unquote selling a strategy. They're not hiring us because of our great team. They're not hiring us because of our great methods. I'm trying to find the least self-congratulatory way to say this, but like, they're hiring me or my teammates because they believe in us to lead them through that process to get where it is that we're trying to get to. We don't even really think about, all right, at the end of this, I'm going to write a one-line strategy and that's what I'm selling. It's the, we're going on a journey over there. I'm going to continue to get you closer and closer to what it is that we're going to land on. In the very end, the final words that end up on the page in the center of the box or the triangle or whatever it might be, as long as we've got to a point where you're in the right strategic space, it's a big win for us, because what you've been buying is, you're buying leadership and we've provided that leadership to get you there.
I like that, because there are other people who do strategy work who are actually less interested in the journey together. They're interested in getting somewhere and getting somewhere quickly. Sometimes they get frustrated, like, I gave you the thing. We gave you the thing. Why isn't that working? But it's interesting to acknowledge that people want to be on a journey and to work that out. You mentioned excited. Do you feel that the main emotion that people feel when they're bringing you projects and opportunities is that they're excited? Are they ever not excited? Are they ever frustrated or beaten down or actually anxious about their own industry?
I am happy to say, and maybe it's perhaps because we have an agency called Positive, usually when the clients call us, I'm going to call them cautiously optimistic, which is, we think there's something and we think you can get us there. There's a sense of optimism. There's some anxiousness and some nervousness to it. But the fact that they've got to the point where they're calling us means they've already made a string of decisions to get to the point to say, we've decided this is something that we're ready to pursue. We're going to invest in it. We're going to find people who are good at this to go along with them. Excitement hopefully comes in probably halfway through when they've looked around, they're on the journey, it's going, and they've said, yeah, we're going in the right direction here. This is interesting. That's when the excitement comes in. And then we really try to hold that and carry that positive momentum through to the end, where they can get to a point of a crescendo of the project where not only have they landed where they've landed, but they've been a part of that journey. They've been part of the development. They've got ownership in the idea and they're charged up and ready to go.
And then the word hope. It's interesting to think of strategy as an act of hope, especially in a career or in an industry or a part of the industry that does attract cynics and people who are cynical. And I defend cynicism and sarcasm because I do believe they're useful critical thinking tools. But if you can't turn them off at times, they're going to hurt you and people around you. That's all I'd say about that. Talk to me about hope in strategy, because, you know, I've seen things presented to clients who weren't excited, who were nervous, who were a bit upset about what's happening to their own industries, for example, in publishing. And then people, or we would present them strategy, and they would say, this is the first time I felt good about my industry in the past 2 years.
Yeah, I love that. I bet that felt great. I think hope comes in at the beginning of the process, which is, if you think about a typical client of ours, our work is actually split probably 50-50 between brand team, CMO, brand management, and 50% on the innovation side. So innovation directors and innovation teams. So for the two of them, when we engage with them, they're at a point of the beginning of a process where they've spent much more time and energy than we ever will have. They've convinced their upper management that they're ready to invest in this. It is not generally a feeling of pessimism and anxiety. There may be some tension of, okay, all eyes on me now, it's time for me to perform. But for the kind of person who hears all eyes on me, it's time for me to perform, those are our best clients. And those are the kind of people that get along with us well. This sense of, I'm sticking my neck out to try to do something differently here. I've got partners on the journey to help me do that. And in addition to that side of hope, the other side, again, with an agency called Positive, we spend lots of time thinking about, One of the phrases we use is, we believe people are filled with good intentions and the brands that make it easiest for people to activate those intentions win. We're not trying to change the world. We're just trying to give people a better afternoon. And most clients that we talk to, they believe in their company and they believe in their products, whether it be gum and candy or pharma or entertainment or whatever it is. They think they've got something that makes people's afternoons a little better or brings people a little bit of joy. And the ability for us to find a way to present their brand in a positive light, adding a dose of ease or happiness or contentedness or success to somebody's day, like that gets them really excited. And there is a sense of hope behind that. You know, we don't often go into challenges where clients come and say, here's our list of problems we need to solve. We instead get approached, or we try to have first conversations, which is, what is the best possible solution for the way your brand might behave in this situation? What's the most positive role it can have in anybody's everyday life? Let's go aim for that. And from there, we can then find our inspiration and go. And it does bring hope and optimism, not only from a business standpoint, but from a strategy development standpoint of, we're feeling pretty good about what we're doing here. And we're shedding a nice light on the brand that we hope connects with people in a way that's meaningful.
Yeah, it's funny. I like a good problem. I advocate for problems, and I get frustrated with people who use optimism to bully people, which is to say, we're optimistic here. We don't talk about negative things or problems. But it's interesting here you talk about what to me is a bit of an alternate universe, and I could totally see how that would work. But I also like problems, and I've read enough to believe in them. So just going back to buying of strategy, what have you learned about the main obstacles that, because as you said, once someone's talking to you, there have been a series of decisions that have already been made, maybe even a loose budget allocation as well, maybe even an RFP or some kind of brief.
Right.
But what are the main barriers that a strategy buyer has to overcome once they start talking to people like you?
You know, as someone who talks a lot, you got me a bit quiet for a moment. By the time they're talking to us, the challenge that they have, I mean, I think there's maybe some caution they have to make sure that they are creating something that feels authentic to their brand and feels something that they can sell into their upper management. Mm-hmm. But by the time they're talking to us, the caution of buying a strategy and the challenges of buying a strategy are rarely on the forefront. They are here because they're active. They're talking to us because they want to figure it out. You know, some of the reason it works well is we take them through a process where we've been very thoughtful about what they've done in the past. We're always intentionally pushing to try to get them to open their eyes to see things in new ways, even sometimes to what my teammates might call a fault of. As we're working our way through, we're pushing into a space to say, we know they're never going to go here. This is way too far. But taking them here then sheds light on the space that we're going to land in. So we're building safety around the process for them. We're pushing them in the right ways. We've got them excited about what it is we're trying to do, and we've got them feeling good about their brand. By the time we're working our way through our process, they're excited to see where we're going and to take our way through. And there aren't as many challenges as selling those strategies as you might think.
Okay. Yeah, I guess that makes sense, because if they're even talking to an independent agency in the first place and a company that's perhaps not known to senior management, if they're massive, maybe they're more independently minded. Maybe they're just really hungry to make a well thought through, like they trust their decisions, and they might have sussed you out. They might have dug around and have some kind of contact with you. So I can understand why that the purchase, sorry for using kind of clunky language like buy and purchase.
No, it's fine.
Think sometimes it leads to a different kind of conversation. I could see why that might be not too much of a long process. Like, what do you have a sense of what the average time from first interaction to signing of scope would be?
You know, it varies a little based on project scope. You know, some of the work that we do are 6 or 8 month, even year long projects where big brand is completely trying to reposition itself, multi-phase strategy process with RFPs going out to different agencies. And boy, that might take 6 weeks from kickoff to end. But on the other hand, I was on a phone call this morning, a friend of mine at a CPG company called and said, hey, we got a project for you. And I think that took 7 minutes.
It's a friend though. Okay. I like that. Yeah.
One note, and I don't mean to push through it. I use the word friend. I might use the word friend more liberally than most.
Yeah.
Having done this for a bit, I've got quote unquote friends in lots of places. Mm-hmm. And we are this intentionally small agency. We have a decently wide client roster across the year or across the years. But we have a pretty small base of clients that we work with. There's probably 6 or 8 clients that give us 70% of our business. Mm-hmm. And then we've got another 10 or 15 that are spinning through the rest. Mm-hmm. So to say a friend called is actually more common practice than not.
Yeah, I get it. As someone that you have like a professional trust with, maybe you talk about things outside of work together, but it's just, it's doing business together is not difficult, right?
That's absolutely.
What, right. Yeah, I get that. Yeah. Is there much seasonality to your work?
Oh, yeah, for sure. And actually, we're coming into the scary slow part. So generally, it would be odd to start in Q4, but it actually makes sense to start in Q4. So typically, October, November, December are, you know, like tax season for the accountants. It's busy every day. Everyone's either desperately trying to finish projects by the end of the year or kick off projects for the next year. Mm. October 1 through December 20, all hands on deck all day long, no vacations, at it. Then typically you're carrying through working all those projects January, February, March. March tends to slow a little. We're in a very normal pace now, but in August last year, we couldn't catch a phone call to save our life. You know, August is a slow time. Kids are getting ready to go back to school. Families are on vacation. Certain companies have their fiscal years that are ending around that time. So probably July 15 to September 1 is our slowest, whereas Q4, we'll do 3 times as much business in Q4 as we will in Q3.
Mm. How have you built the business to deal with that?
You would think that I would have figured it out by now, huh?
It's hard, right?
It is hard.
Because that seasonality can also overlap with economic cycles and then just random spontaneous things.
Yeah, and it's hard to move that mountain. There are times in the past where I've been publishing articles in June and July about how wonderful it'd be to do projects in August, promoting August is the perfect time to do work. Here's all these good reasons. And people are like, nah, I'm going on vacation. We're not doing anything in August. There's just a natural cycle, I think, to the client side business and a natural cycle on the way it impacts our business. And I don't think it's just ours alone. My peers and competitive agencies, I think we all feel the same way.
Okay. What about personas or the types of people who buy from you? Like I've sat down and thought through my friends who've hired me in the past, and there's two that often pop up, and it's not everyone, but one is a business leader who's trying to build a business as an act of self-expression. I don't know what percentage of the market that is, but that's definitely someone that I attract and the type of person I love working with, because they're trying to work out themselves and how to build a business around it. And they could be small or not. And then there might be a CMO who's got like 5 or 6 agencies and they just need someone to come in and like they've got months and years maybe of data. And they're just like, I just need someone to help me pierce through this on a page or two. Who are your common, I'm going to use the word buyer again, forgive me if it sounds vulgar, but who are your common buyers?
Yeah, there's 2. When we're working with the brand team, CMO, marketing side, my partner Ted and I both came up through the agency side and have a fairly creative bent to our strategy development process and the way that we express our strategies. We probably, to an outsider, look more like creative agency than most consultancies would. So for big brands that are taking on interesting creative challenges, you know, so we've got a leadership brand that's been in X category that's got, you know, 1% growth over the last 5 years. We need some really different creative thinking here. They'll bring us in sort of as their henchmen to come in for this project, help us through this particularly challenging creative process. Mm-hmm. Part of that comes from we've got good relationships with the creative agencies. We work well with planners and creatives. And for that type of thing, you know, where you're a big brand's trying to really change itself and become part of the cultural conversation, become much more current, we get a lot of that. And then separately, you can't see a few of the gray hairs that are coming in here, but having done this a bit and having some nice relationships, sometimes because people will want to model us, you know. They might spend a lot of time working with smaller agencies that are less expensive through processes, but every once in a while, they'll give us a call and say, all right, not only are we doing this, but we're going to have everybody watch this one, and we're going to try to learn as we go through it, because I, who are hiring you, am trying to show them a good example of how this works. You guys know what you're doing. Come on in and actually work at a little open book so you can teach us as we go along.
Mm. Yes. Yeah, the teaching part of it, I think, is really, really important. And it's funny when you reach that part of your career where you're like, oh, I think I need to make this more explicit, not just kind of casually throw it in during a workshop, but actually teaching is a part of the key thing so that people know what to buy and they know how to build up that muscle memory internally so that even what you do with them can survive the bureaucracy it will inevitably walk around. Working in the Midwest, and I know you work with companies all over the place, but working in the Midwest, there are some massive, especially food companies there, but massive companies there with in-house agency teams, with significant media teams and consumer insight teams. And they're all often working with and competing with each other, let alone with agencies. And then I'd imagine you get thrown among the pigeons in that situation. What's going on? Has it changed much in the past 10 years? And how do you navigate that?
Yeah, it is interesting. And there's two sides of that. There's the being brought in within the in-house teams and then working with the outside agencies. So I'll take those in two parts. Mm-hmm. Working within the in-house teams, frankly, those teams are usually pretty excited. So the fact that we're there means my management has bought into this. They see that we need some help here. They're investing to bring in people who are good at it. This is only going to get better. So they're excited through that process. And we find our best relationships are often with those people on those teams who get it really well. And then working with the typical creative agencies, we don't do any work direct for agencies. Agencies don't hire us, but we work early in the process, but we work in partnership with those agencies. We'll lead the process and we'll intentionally say, we don't need you to co-lead this with us. You are valuable because you have a perspective here that's different than the client team and different than us. Please be an active participant through this process. And that works really well. So we end up with really great relationships with our agency partners and planners, getting them to a point where their client's ready to invest in finding a new target, finding a new insight, finding a new way to spin something. They're excited by the process. They know that they need the help getting there. And in the end, when we can get them inspired to create a new brief, create a new strategy, and get them moving, that's really a win all around. I think 10, 15 years ago, when we started some of this stuff, there may have been some tension of, hey, I'm the agency planner, why are you hiring that strategy agency? When strategy agencies were growing. But now it's much more the norm. You know, we've been doing this 14, 15 years. We and all of our competitors are billing millions of dollars doing the strategy work. And I don't think there is expectation that the heavy strategy work's coming from the agency planner anymore. It's being decided ahead of time with the client teams. And then when they engage the agency team to really engage, the clients are just much smarter and much better prepared to give a good briefing, know exactly what it is they're looking for, and let the creative agencies run.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I know that you're all about positivity, but do you ever run into conflict with internal research teams?
It's rarer than you think. I think the only times might be when someone's a little precious about a method that they love that we might not think would be the right tool for the task. But usually, even as we kick off projects, it's not like we get an RFP and put together a 20-page proposal and send it to them. You know, we'll have a conversation where we'll say, all right, we've thought about it. There's a couple different ways that we might get at this, and we discuss different ways to do it and then go create our proposal. So by the time they're getting it, they're already, you know, the warmest of buyers and ready to see what we're seeing. We haven't had too much issues of, you know, showing up the internal researcher. Like, we work really well with those people and we're trying to make it easier for them to do their job. So there may be less of that I'm experiencing than maybe some of my peers. And going back to your original conversation, even about running a strategy agency and selling strategy, you know, part of it comes down to, I think, not just a generic process of an internal team working with an internal group. When they're hiring us, we're a small group. They are really buying me or Ted or one of my teammates. Like, we're buying you because we think you're the right person to lead through this process. So what does that mean that we have to be? So we are relatively strong, enigmatic, extroverted leaders who can walk in and say, we've thought about this, we understand your challenge, we've seen this challenge in 17 other categories that we've worked in, here's what we think you should do. And by the time that the client team has bought that approach, it's been bought in that we're leading them through, we're confident, we know what we're doing, and we're doing it. Once we get to that point, there's really not much conflict to be had. If there's conflict to be had, we probably wouldn't have got the gig.
Okay. That's the power of setting up your own thing and self-selection, which you don't really understand until you've done it and you catch yourself in meetings a few years in, you're like, oh, this is exactly what I want, as opposed to being in someone else's company, like a large agency. You're like, oh, I've got to work this way with these people. So it's great to hear that you've got that congruence. I want to give you a little bit of a confession. It's not for the first time. And then I'm kind of curious about your take on this. And you can psychoanalyze me or you can take the problem as it is. I feel that I'm better at strategy than I was 10 years ago. However, my time in America, I do not have a lot of work to show. And that's why I switched my work to people work, which I love, and it's more fulfilling than ever.
Yeah.
But I had to loosen my stubbornness and idealism for writing strategy and for that to ever lead to something that would be in public. What can you teach me about that dilemma? I'm sure you've experienced it in parts. Granted, I hear that you're attracting clients now and maybe for the whole time that you've been operating, where that might not be a problem. But you do know planners in Chicago and around the place who probably do experience that. Like, how would you coach someone through that?
It can be disheartening, for sure. And for every success, we have 5 or 10 unsuccessful things where we've created something that we think is fantastic that dies. I take great joy and pleasure in finishing what it is that we've been tasked to do. And then by the time the team has that innovation strategy or has the communication strategy, there are so many next steps between strategy is all agreed, we're aligned and we're ready to go, and that product ending up on the shelf, or that communication strategy turning into a campaign. And I think if you give yourself the freedom to be able to say, I got them in the best position I can get them to, there's 19 other things that may have got in the way to keep this from getting to shelf, it doesn't diminish my sense of the work that we did. At least for me, it works. Yeah. I mean, I do want to match that up with, there is great pleasure walking through a typical Midwestern grocery store and just walking down the shelves and looking at products and saying, oh yeah, look, hey, 2 years ago we worked on that thing and here it is. And that moment of joy really is great. Sometimes these things just take time. But getting to a point where you've led them to the right space, even if they're not exactly taking what it is and you're moving it forward, you can see shades of what it is that you did that influenced the final deliverable.
Yeah. And I guess what you're talking about is recalibrating your internal speak from the idea of giving up or failing to being, you delivered the task, you can't control everything, but hopefully there'll be little incremental change that you've affected, and that's where you find the joy. Or you find the joy actually in doing the task and in the journey of taking the people to through this land of hope. So I get that. I get that. Sometimes I've been a bit nervous that I feel like I've given up, that I don't push hard enough. But, you know, I do feel I've been in agencies in other parts of the world where if there was an amazing idea or strategy and we just couldn't get it through, we would expect the CEO, CCO, or CSO to phone or have a lunch with the most senior client. And then in my time in New York, I didn't really ever see that. And that's not to say it doesn't exist. It's just to say that in where I worked, I didn't see it.
Yeah, and I don't see that, and I don't often have that conversation myself. If things die, things die.
That's interesting, because that, I don't know. I don't know if that's common. I think in places that do exceptional work all the time, the management takes real accountability, even for the most junior person's work, and they go fight for it in a friendly way. That you don't see that at all?
You know, with the mix of work that we're doing, if 50% of the work is in innovation and product development, and we get to a point where we say, you tasked us with creating an interesting new positioning for this product that you have that's going off to a new space. We gave you the best freaking positioning you could ever have. Along the way, you learned there's not enough money to enter that space, or the cost of goods of getting to that space are too hard, or you're stretching your team too far to try to get to that space. I take all of those as the realities of business, and it doesn't put extra weight on my shoulder as much as maybe it should, but I hold that as, you know, all the other extenuating circumstances around the work.
Okay. Tell me either about the principles and or the questions that you ask yourselves when you're selling your work, when you're structuring scopes, maybe when you do annual or whatever it is planning for your own company. For example, you know, one of the questions I ask myself is like, what's the least I need to do to make the biggest impact? A principle is I don't want to sell hours. You know, what are some of the questions that are at the heart of how you structure, how you charge, and how you operate?
I'm going to admit, I'm not the first person to have used this, I don't think. I'm sure I heard it from somebody else. But when we think about the work that we do and potential projects that we look at, we've got three filters that we put them through. It's fun, fame, and fortune. And ideally, on any potential project, you might have a little bit of all those. It's fun to work on. It's a good story that you can tell someone else to get some new business, and it's profitable for you. How often do we get all three of those? Super rarely. So from a business standpoint, we have conversations about, okay, this is probably a lot of fun. We'll never be able to tell anybody and not make any money on it. How much of that work do we want? Mm-hmm. Versus there's other work, which is it's easier. It's not that fun. It's not that interesting to tell somebody else, but boy, it sure is profitable. And we think through those in terms of different ways to pursue business and different ways of getting at it.
Okay, I like that. I like that. Can you think of an example of a fame project?
I have a classic one from back in the day, and then there's one that we're working on now. Classic one through time. I was lucky enough, starting in 2005, working with the Coors Brewing Company, the big boom of Coors Light of the late 2000s and early 2010s, with all the focus on cold activation and coldest beer in the world and everything that they did to catapult that brand ahead. I was one of the team members through that. And I think through time, I've done 140 projects for Miller Coors, maybe, over the past time. And being associated with that, that's a lot of money. They make a lot of stuff. It's a very loud category. It's easy to point at examples from that category. On the flip, I have done work recently within this last year, which is fun and potential fame, and a job that we took. We knew we were frankly doing it at a discount, but a friend of mine became CMO of one of the NFL teams here, going through very ambitious plans for a full brand relaunch. Mm-hmm. So from tangible things of colors and uniforms and logos and the branding of the team through presence in the local community, how to be a modern football brand at a time when NFL is under lots of attention and scrutiny. Plus, it's just generally fun being in sports and you've got an opportunity to kick off a new brand in a new way. That's been a very quote unquote fun project that there will be fame to come once it all launches. It hasn't come yet, but it's the one that I'm looking forward to the most. And again, as I said, with the amount of time and money we spent on it, we may have done that project for free. But we had fun doing it. Life is meant to be lived. Not everything's about making every dollar all the time. There's other ways to make up the margin, and it was a great experience.
Yeah, like when you're doing something like that, that is, I mean, NFL in Chicago or in many cities around America is massive. New York is, it is, but you don't, it's not, you know, New York's just a whole bunch of everything, but you travel to Chicago and it's basketball and it's NFL and it's baseball, and that's what's on all the televisions, at least when I walk around. So that'd be, that's awesome. And then let alone all the cultural and social challenges facing that organization, let alone being able to create stuff that people are going to wear. That's sounds like a very nice project. Very cool. Last question about selling strategy. What have you learned about selling strategy? You know, what are key lessons that you've taken away from selling strategy that you try to apply to everything that comes in now? You know, have you made missteps along the way that you're like, no, we're not doing it like that again. We're going to change our scopes.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that we spend a lot time at the beginning of each of the projects is trying to understand, especially within potential new clients, inside those organizations. And client organizations are organizations and living, breathing organisms that all sort of run a little differently. And as you're trying to sell something in or take something that you've developed and bring it to life, different organizations use the same words to mean different things. They have different processes for the way that they do things, and actually figuring out, like, what kind of marketing team are you? And what is it that you guys believe in? And where are you trying to go? And then how can we develop a strategy that fits your personality and your mentality? Different clients face really different challenges. You know, we're with some clients who are in hyper-competitive categories where they're scrapping for every point of share every day, and it's a very competitive driven, you're finding your inspiration in a category, you know, nuts and bolts of the details. We need to put our functional benefit hat on and go in and put on some boxing gloves and get at it. If you take that same approach to someone who's trying to relaunch a football team, though, it's just completely wrong. But if you take the relaunch a football team and bring it to the competitive category, that's really wrong. So I think taking some time to understand not only, like, what are they asking me, but who are they as people? Where are they? where are they going and how can I understand as much about that so that when I'm presenting our work, it's pushing them to a point that is just uncomfortable enough, but still speaking their language.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, the language thing's so important, increasingly important, because these words are getting used by so many more people than even 10 years ago and in different ways and sometimes with no specific intention other than, I don't know, it sounds important to say strategy or strategic.
Yes. I wrote an article 10 years ago called Give Me My Insight Back.
Did you ever get it back?
No, just in general at that time, the word insight went from sort of the planning departments of agencies across then all the research departments of all of our client teams. And they would say an insight is like, you know, mom's got a busy life and doesn't have time to make dinner.
Yeah.
I'm like, can I just have that word back?
Yeah, that's also the example I use when I'm talking about what an insight is not. What do you put that down to? You saw that start to happen about 10 years ago?
Yeah, I think some of it is things come and go, right? We're going to be really good insight hunters and go find some insights, may have then got pushed out by we're going to be design thinkers and we're going to go create a lot of things. Now we're going to be really big data-driven stuff. You know, think trends come and go in the business, and there was just a time where using what had formerly been the language of a small group of planners became more common language inside client teams, which was really exciting for the people who understood it and really got it. Mm-hmm. And a little bit challenging for people who you could tell were just sort of mimicking.
Okay. Yeah. So you've done strategy and research work for banks, beer, candy, cookie brands, gum, snacks. So basically things that are everywhere. How do you even do that?
Yeah. I think this is a bit of for my partners and I, who've got an approach to the way that we do our work. Because in addition to those things that you named, which are all tangible stuff, we also work in movies and entertainment and, you know, the things that people do every day. And having a passion for understanding those boring things that people do every day that are actually huge brands that are the things you do every day because they're so big, finding a way to understand the nuance of what sometimes might look like a big gray middle is the key to doing that. And I've talked quite a bit in the past about there's lots of different strategists who have different approaches to doing their work. Some might be really inspired by pop culture, and we need to find a way to take your brand and infuse it into the pop culture conversation, and they turn to pop culture for their inspiration, and that's where they get it. Or are there others who are very excellent at using data to understand growth opportunities and niches to grow, and they're really focused on those sorts of tasks? And maybe it's my age or upbringing, or, you know, I got trained up through Leo Burnett back in the day when the planning team was really about understanding people, and I'm a people person. So I'm the type of person who, when I need inspiration for the type of product that people are going to use every day, I get in my car and I go to Walmart. I spend more time in Walmart than most people. It's the biggest, most successful retail store in the history of ever. Mm. Everybody that we're selling products to are there. You spend time, you stand there and you say, okay, I don't need a big idea that's going to snap heads when it's on television. I need to figure out a way to get that mom who's pushing her kid through that cart to change one of her existing routines and behaviors to pick up my client's product for the first time or to reconsider my product in a new way. What is that person going through? What challenges am I asking to ask them to change their behaviors? And why would that person ever want to listen to something that I've got to say? Mm-hmm. And when you do that consistently, and now I've married that up with, you know, loads of research work. Being a strategist for me has always been a matter of we're thinker doers. It's not like we're strategists and have separate researchers that we work with. I think I added it up sometime. I've done 18,000 interviews with people talking about everything from, you know, toothpaste to where you're going in life and the role of money in the world. And when you talk to that many people about that many things, that then drives our brand name, our positioning, you know, our line is we see upside everywhere. Like finding ways to understand people's everyday life really is where we get that inspiration. And from that, you can then work on these giant categories. Like if you think about the number one selling candy, they sell $2 billion worth of candy a year and candy costs $1. That's 2 billion transactions. Mm-hmm. Like understanding the nuance of how do I get to that big middle group and keep them excited about this brand is a hard challenge. It's much harder to grow a big brand that everybody knows than it is to market an exciting new thing that's actually different and has a different reason for being. Mm-hmm.
Do you have any go-to questions that you love asking on research?
You know, there's two. So actually, when we do research, whether it's a one-on-one interview or a group of things, I actually start every conversation with the same question, which my friend and former partner, Ross McLean, taught me. The first question we ask everybody is, what is the one best thing that happened to you since you woke up yesterday morning? And that's where we start. Mm-hmm. And then later, when we're looking at concepts or we're looking at ideas or we're tossing theories around, I never ask, like, which of these ideas is most exciting to you? I would instead say, which of these do you need more in your life? This is what this is about. This is what that's about. This is what this is about. If you could have a little more of any of these three things in your life, which of these do you want in your life? And it sort of changes the conversation from, I want to buy that thing, to, I'm really interested in what that thing's about.
Mm. What do you find that the first question does? Does it sort of prime them for an sort of just pokes them in the brain, they wake up and they're like, oh, this is going to be a different conversation, I'll pay more attention to this. Does it prime them to be positive, and is that even a useful thing?
Yeah, well, it is a little bit of both of those. The first is, there's a casualness to it of, oh yeah, this is a little different. I guess he wants to actually talk to me rather than just ask me questions. Mm. But it does start a conversation in a positive frame, and people literally sit in front of me and put smiles on their face and tell me about the best thing that's happened to them since yesterday. And again, when you ask 10,000 people that question, I feel like I've heard most every answer there is to be had. And because of that, it's an easy way sort of to benchmark within 30 seconds, like, okay, I already know a little bit about you because you answered the same thing that 47 other people have answered. Mm-hmm. And I remember all those conversations with them. It helps gear me up for beginning of an opening of a research conversation with them.
Have you thought about, or perhaps even done this, but have you ever thought about writing a book about that question and the answers?
I so wish that I started recording it back in time. Of course, I should have, Mark. Hindsight being 2020, I didn't.
Well, there's always the future. That's the upside of the future.
Yeah, there is.
You can always go and do it. That'd be really interesting.
Yeah, for sure.
Could you talk me through one example of research that you've done in the past year, if possible? It's just something that you found, you know, obviously nothing that's proprietary that you can't talk about, but one thing that you found that just after all these interviews struck you as being something that was really worth finding.
I do. And it points at a particularly tough challenge. And you might, when I tell you, you might say, yes, you might have guessed that, but we're working in the banking category for one of the big banks. The bank was itself feeling a little disconnected from its customer base. If you looked at their previous marketing, it was a little quote unquote big thinking as opposed to thinking big. They were looking to get more real, more connected to people. So we did a big round of exploratory work, trying to understand role of money, perception of power of money, the way people think about banks, the involvement of banks in their communities. Good insight hunting work, came out with four or five top insights. We built with the agency team different creative concepts to go against those positioning areas, went out for another round of research, and the big learning that we had was it did not matter which concepts we showed to which segment we recruited in, no matter what we showed first to anybody, whenever we showed anything that came from a bank, the same reaction came from everybody, which is, that's interesting, but I don't believe you in the slightest. You know, someone looking at your concept saying, I just think you're full of shit. I think you're lying to me. I think you're tricking me. Like, what's the story behind the story? The banking category is so full of distrust, and people think they're being, banks are out to get them. Mm. So then you take on the interesting challenge of, okay, client team, we went out and did research. We brought back what we thought were great insights that we said we're going to turn into really good concepts that people were going to like. And guess what? None of them work. But frankly, it didn't matter what we wrote. No matter what we wrote, it wasn't going to work because of the space that we were working in.
Yeah.
Because you're talking like a bank. The bigger challenge is we need to figure out how to inspire you to stop talking like a bank and almost restart building a relationship with people. Take a point of view on something, talk like a human, say something that people can agree with, which is an interesting question of like, what can we say that it's hard to disagree with because you want to disagree with everything we have to say.
Yeah, but I mean, also in that industry, actions are going to speak louder than words. And you only need to spend 30 minutes digging around online to find new scandals and to wonder why America hates socialism for humans but likes it for corporations, and watch a documentary or two and you're like, regardless of the political angle, and you're like, hang on, why did people keep getting away with this stuff? Like, why did people get to keep all the money from the bailout and the CEOs got massive bonuses? Yeah. What's up? What? Don't talk to me. Fix that. So I get it.
I am happy to share one affirming thing for the for us in the industry, either the banking industry or the strategy industry as a whole, which is we did help them land in this, you know, human truth or belief that they could put out that people would agree with. People are generally agreeing with it to a point now that the management team is saying, okay, that's advertising, that's fine. We now need to walk the talk. How do we live up to the work that we're putting out in the world? Because right now we're not living up to it and we really want to. And that's really exciting.
Very cool. All right. I got a final question, but it's double pronged.
I like it.
Double pronged. And you know what it's going to be after I ask you the first part. The first part of this question is for someone who's new to a strategy career, what's the upside?
Oh, good. You're going to ask me the second one or should I go with that?
Oh, you were starting there. You know what the second one is, though.
Yeah. So the upside is, if you're really dedicated to getting into a strategy career, and if you get a couple early breaks, and if you are smart and dedicated to honing your craft, you will, in time, get to spend time with other smart, dedicated people who are really good at this, and you can lead them and inspire them in ways that you can see fulfills them and is fulfilling back to you. I like that a lot. As a side note, yes, if you do it long enough, the products that you work on or the communication strategies that you work on are on the shelf or in media, and that's pretty fulfilling as well. There's lots of other ways to get that satisfaction, though, but from a strategy standpoint, smart people like hanging out with smart people and good strategists like good strategists, and it's a really interesting group if you can get into it where you feed off each other and you build from each other, unlike maybe some creative sides where you're competing. There's not competition in the strategy world. There's no awards in the strategy world. Like, we're all trying to lift each other up.
Yeah, it's, I know I've said this before, but having done talks and training in tens and tens of places, a lot of times people come up and go, that was really cool. But you know what was the best? Just being in a room of people like me. Holy crap. I didn't even know they existed.
Right, exactly.
I've heard that a lot. Okay, you know what the next question is? It's because I want to challenge your positivity. If someone's new to a strategy career or really desperate to get one, what's a potential downside that you think it's worth preparing for or at least being aware of?
Can I use the word balls?
I think you just did, yeah.
You have to work your balls off. When I was running the previous group that I was running, I think I did 15 years of work in 9 years. Especially when you're one of the partners or the founder of an agency, you're not only being a strategist, but you are being a business person, you're being an entrepreneur, you're being the finance guy. If the more you take on, the more you take on. There is a bit of addictiveness to it as well. The positive momentum there's nothing so powerful as positive momentum. Once you get a bit of it in you, then you're rolling, and at some point it can get exhausting.
Some listeners, they might find this question vulgar, but I don't usually
go for it.
Follow up the metaphor, but I'm going to follow up the metaphor. How can a strategist avoid the chafing?
It's an interesting one. And this might be the more negative response than you were looking for, which is, I don't know, and I don't know that you can. And if you really want to be good at it and make good money and be successful, you might have to be the kind of person who's okay with some chafe.
Yeah. And then also just being in
a deep sigh. Yeah.
I think sometimes just a little bit of cream for the chafe can be hearing what you just said, that's not unusual. You know, as long as you're not harming yourself or other people because of it, and you get to define the word harm there, the listener. Right. But sometimes just hearing that, sometimes hearing that other people are going through the same thing is the chafing cream for
them. Yeah, and I think, you know, the little bit that helps is I see plenty of people who just, quote unquote, work too much. You notice I didn't say I worked too much. Because work too much means you're not being efficient or there's undue expectation on you. And that's a little different than being a lead strategist. As a lead strategist, the hard part is you just never stop thinking. You're always thinking about the challenges. You're always on task. You know, I'm working on 4 projects right now. I think about them all the time. Mm-hmm. You never know where the inspiration comes from. That's where the chafe comes from, as opposed to I have a stack of papers that I need to move from box A to box B.
Yeah, it's what I would call high RAM, computer RAM work.
Correct.
Yeah, right. and this is awesome. You got to work out how to take care of yourself, but you're probably not going to find answers to that by looking at posts on LinkedIn. It's like a personal journey.
Oh, it's been so key to me, and I've tried to infuse it in my teammates of you need to do something else that's quite different from this. So for me, part of my passion is building and building spaces. You've been to my space here in Chicago. You know, over the past few years, I've built out 4 different offices. I've built out 3 houses. When I'm done with this career, I may actually go into building a destination of some sort. Mm. It's very different. I see tangible results. I get my knuckles dirty. I get sweaty. I learn how to do things that I don't know how to do. When I'm in the midst of, I just remodeled the house that I was the general contractor on. Like when I'm doing that, finally, I'm not thinking about my clients a little bit, mm-hmm. and it's giving me a break because I'm learning something else, and it's taking up that intellectual curiosity.
Yeah, I love it. We're probably better built for that building life than the thinking life, and I constantly come across, I'm going to call it research, but research and opinions that if you get stuck in your head, move.
Yeah.
Do something different, and that's one way to kind of to focus it. Tom, I really appreciate your thoughts on running a strategy agency, buying and selling strategy. Super interesting. Thank you very much for joining me on Sweathead today.
It was a pleasure.
Peace.